Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Today, from the river to the sea, oh yes, Palestine will be free. Israeli defense forces colluding with settlers have escalated their attacks against Palestinians from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem's Old City, killing dozens, including children, and wounding hundreds more. We're joined by Rashid Ismail Khalidi, a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East, and Edward Said, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University and director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs, and author of The Hundred Years' War on Palestine. He'll discuss the violence in Jerusalem as Israeli police and Zionist settlers rain down death on protesters rallying against the forced expulsions of Palestinian families from the occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, and the Israeli force raid on Al-Aqsa on one of the holiest nights of Ramadan as part of the 100 Years war on Palestine. Professor Khalidi, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I think actually that the subtitle of the book, which is The History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, sums up what has been going on in Jerusalem. You mentioned Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood immediately to the north of the Old City, where there has been an aggressive campaign together with other neighborhoods of the city, inside the Old City and other neighborhoods around the Old City, like Sirwan to the south. There's been an aggressive campaign by militant settler groups, completely backed by the Israeli state, by the court system, by the military, by the border guards, by the police, by undercover agents, by the courts, by the registration system. I mean, a whole panoply of state agencies have supported these settlers in attempts to take over Arab property in the overwhelmingly Arab areas of East Jerusalem that are seen as strategically critical to Israeli control, strategic and demographic and on-the-ground control of the city, of the eastern part of the city. And Sheikh Jarrah is a flashpoint for this for a number of reasons, mainly because it's so important in terms of connecting the Old City to the neighborhoods, the Arab neighborhoods to the north. And so that's one element of this. This is an effort to, in the words used by the Israeli government, Judaize the Arab, overwhelming Arab East Jerusalem, and to create several belts of Jewish populated settlements close to the Old City, in the Old City, and around the Old City and on the outskirts of the city, so such that the concentric rings, as it were, of little fortresses. They're not actually fortresses, they're settlements. In some cases, they're just a small group of houses. In some cases, they are actual settlements on top of hilltops. So this is part of a drive that has been going on for 54 years to erase the Arab character of East Jerusalem, to concretize, put into concrete and put into bodies, people, putting people into place such that the eastern part of the city is Judaized and such that a claim, an exclusive Israeli claim to not just West Jerusalem, but East Jerusalem can be forcibly imposed. So that's one element of what's been going on. Another element of what's been going on have been infringements on celebrations of Ramadan, which usually take place on the steps of the steps leading down to the Damascus Gate, and which the Israeli police sealed off at the beginning of Ramadan, causing all kinds of clashes with young Palestinians who, during the nights when people usually have meals and socialize, they fast during the day and then in the evening they eat and they socialize. That's one of the few open spaces in the entire Old City or around the entire Old City, and people used to congregate there every night of Ramadan, and the Israeli police fenced it off and prevented people from doing so, and that provoked another resistance to this on the part of people who are used to having that space in which to enjoy their post-prayers socializing. Finally, you had a march through the Old City by a fanatical right-wing anti-Palestinian racist group which is determined to extirpate the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem. That's what they say. They want to eliminate the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem. They say Jerusalem belongs exclusively to Israel, which in fact many Israeli parties agree with. And that should be implemented not just by the bulldozers and by the armed settlers backed by the state, but by actually physically assaulting Palestinians and scaring them into leaving. And so the march by these folks into the old city caused yet another set of problems and more clashes. Finally, you have had the Israeli security forces on successive nights when people congregate to pray evening prayers of Ramadan, which marks the breaking of the fast. They've assaulted the Haram al-Sharif, the enclosure around the two main mosques, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. People usually pray inside the mosques and also out on the esplanade around them, the so-called Haram al-Sharif sanctuary, which for Jews is the area around the Temple Mount. And those assaults, together with what's been going on in Sheikh Jarrah, together with these attacks by this extreme right-wing party, which, by the way, is inspired, openly proclaims itself to be inspired by the Kahanist movement, Meir Kahan, the founder of the Jewish mm-hmm. Defense League, later a member of Knesset, later expelled from the Knesset, later assassinated, is the spiritual mentor of this group that launched that march, and that is one of many groups that's been involved in these attacks on Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, in the Old City, and most recently the police actions against Palestinians around in and around the mosques. I mean, they've actually been firing stun grenades and tear gas canisters into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. All of this is,
I just
is
want
a
to ask you one thing about
sorry,
that. Are you know, yeah. in the midst of this description, which will continue, but the Israeli forces firing rubber tip bullets, tear gas, stun grenades in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, wounding hundreds of Palestinians during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. What do you think are the particular sparks politically that have ignited the ferocity and the aggression of the Israeli Defense Forces, and to the point where Knesset members are there and where they act in unison with groups
right.
like Kahani Hakai and so on?
Well, I think you have to look at which Knesset members they are. They are, in the case of Bezalel Smotrich, he is a member of this extreme right-wing party that I just mentioned, which in the past was considered beyond the pale by all Israeli parties, and now is being courted by the prime minister as a member of his prospective coalition. And I think that's where you have to look. Israeli politics is sort of like lemmings going off the deep end being the right in the rightwards direction. This has been happening for many years, but we now have Kahanists in the Israeli Knesset again, for the first time since Kahan himself was a member back in the day. And I think that the desperation of the prime minister to form a right-wing coalition, including these people, has led to the government, the military, the police in Jerusalem, the border guards, and so on, catering to them in a way that they have always done, but to a much more extreme extent. In other words, I think that showing that he's tough on the Arabs is a way of hardening the right wing, his appeal to the right wing parties that he wants to be part of the coalition. He failed Netanyahu, of course, to form a government. It's now another person. Yair Lapid has been designated to form a government by the president. But I think Netanyahu is as continuing prime minister, has been operating in a way that's meant to shore up his electoral chance.
Let's plow even deeper. The significance of this aggressive assault, settlers and troops attacking Palestinians and solidarity activists who have stood in the path of the invasion and actually abducted Palestinian family members from the particular neighborhood, Sheikh Jarrah, the import of that and the import of besieging Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. Why the escalation at this juncture?
As I've described, you have this extraordinary right-wing, rightwards march of Israeli politics. Sentiments kill the Arabs, sentiments expel the Arabs, sentiments of hate, open hatred, were things that were frowned upon in the past. Quite frequently, you'd have discriminatory, segregationist, racist practices, but nobody would say out loud some of the things that are now being said by members of the Israeli Knesset. Nobody would act in the way, quite the way, that we've been seeing recently. And I have to say, I think that the demagoguery and the right-wing populism that Netanyahu has used to maintain himself in power, he's the longest-serving Israeli prime minister in the country's history, has to some extent fostered this. I have to say something else that's fostered it is a pipeline of money coming from the United States in support of these extremist organizations, in support of extremist settler groups, in support of efforts to take over Arab property, steal, seize, occupy, and then evict and displace the indigenous Arab population, not just in Jerusalem and all over the West Bank, but in particular in Jerusalem. These organizations, in many cases, are 501c3s, which is to say they're supposedly charitable organizations. What they're doing is a violation of international law. They're helping in the settlement of the population of the occupying power in the occupied territories. That's a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. It is mind-boggling that the U.S. government allows this to continue, that allows organizations that are carrying out these racist acts, these horrible acts of expulsion and eviction and displacement and theft and ethnic cleansing, to enjoy the category of 501c3 charities. I mean, that could be revoked by a stroke of the pen in the Treasury Department, that status. The money might continue to flow, but at least they would not have the sanction of the U.S. government, and these would not be tax-deductible contributions to these groups, which means all the rest of us are paying more taxes to make up for the taxes that are exempt on money flowing to settlement and other right-wing Israeli organizations.
And who are some of those 501c3s that are so pronounced in their support and their financing and the license that they have to do so from the U.S. government of the settler movement and the ultra-right wing, although I don't even know how one says ultra-right wing. It's kind of the dominant, predominant philosophic reality and the government policy. So ultra-right wing, it is the policy of Zionism, which is the Israeli state. But who are some of those entities that we should be conscious of here?
They mainly fly under the radar. This group, Lechava, probably has, I don't know the details myself, but many of the settler groups and many of the major settlements have 501c3s attached to them. It was well reported that Jared Kushner, for example, was a major donor to groups, 501c3s, that were engaged in specific Israeli settlements in Beit Il and in other places in the occupied West Bank. Similarly, Ambassador Friedman, Trump's ambassador to Israel, was a prominent supporter of several of these settler groups that were also 501c3s. The ones that are operating in Jerusalem are less well known, but it is apparently the case that many of these benefit from this 501c3 status. This is a subject that's going to be raised increasingly in the near future, because it's an example of how what is being done by Israeli governments that are intent on changing the geography and the demography of the occupied territories are doing and could only do with the support of the U.S. government, whether it's weapons that are being used in violation of U.S. Export laws, which mandate that they can only be used for self-defense, or whether it's money going to 501c3s, or whether it's American diplomatic protection of Israel when international bodies try to sanction it or to in some way restrain Israel from behaving as it behaves, whether in Jerusalem or whether in the occupied territories. We're now riveted on Jerusalem, but this kind of thing is going on all over the West Bank: cutting down of trees, settler assaults on farmers, preventing people from harvesting their crops, incredibly restrictive regulations that prevent farmers from getting to their property, theft of their property. And it is happening in the Jordan River Valley. It's happening in other parts of the West Bank. We're now seeing it house by house on a specific street in a specific neighborhood, Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. But this kind of thing has been going on in the Old City for decades. I was present when settlers tried to climb into a property belonging to our family from an adjacent property that they had taken over, and they were kept out. But this is something that happens all the time, all over the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem. And the tragic thing is that the United States runs interference for Israel diplomatically, provides some of the weapons that are used to suppress the Palestinians and make this possible, and allows massive funding to go to these organizations that are engaged in settlement with the massive support, again, of the Israeli government.
Just recently, within the last days, there has been from Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOC, a critique and a kind of plaintive cry to the U.S. and Israeli government. What, even children being killed? At least 9 children have died. Where is the consideration? Now, I'm not quite sure what they're calling for, but what is your assessment, even in its first 100 days with Biden, but we certainly know who his foreign policy chiefs are that are part of his administration, and after all, he was part of the Obama administration, which fundamentally there was not a great point of difference or recognition of the slogan that I always hold up is, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. So how do you assess the Biden administration, if you can, in its limited time in office, as to dealing with these policies that you have and the license the U.S. and the money that it has pumped in itself to support the aggressions, the continuing Nakba catastrophe that has been launched against by the Israeli government against the Palestinian people?
Let me just say a couple of words about what some members of Congress are trying to do. You mentioned, I think, appeals by several members of Congress and a couple of senators, Senator Warren and Senator Sanders in particular, and a number of congressmen and congresswomen. I think the most substantial effort has been made by Congresswoman Betty McCollum of Minnesota. I think she represents the district in Minneapolis or in the Minneapolis area, which is based on a bill that she sponsored together with 24 co-sponsors in the last session of Congress, the one that ended in January, which called for the United States money to not be used for the detention of Palestinian children. She has since expanded this House resolution to include, in addition to preventing American tax dollars from being used for the detention of children, to prevent those tax dollars from being used for anything that involves annexation or anything that involves home demolition, the demolition of Palestinian homes. She had, as I said, 24 co-sponsors on the initial measure in the last session. Every single one of those people was reelected. And she has, at last count, I think 16 co-sponsors on the newer measure. So I think that there is some movement among some people of conscience in the American political class. But to go to the other part of your question, which is the Biden administration, I don't think that applies to Biden. I don't think that the president, the vice president, or the secretary of state, or the national security advisor, Jake Walz, Tony Blinken, or Vice President Harris and President Biden, is on the same wavelength as these people. Basically, they are continuing to run interference for almost anything and everything that the Israeli government does. I mean, they will bleat the occasional demand or request that both sides de-escalate. But when push comes to shove, as has happened in the latest fighting in and around Gaza, the State Department spokesman basically said Israel has the right of self-defense. And Israel interprets that very broadly, to kill children, to kill women, saying that it's protecting its own population. Clearly, 2 women were killed in Israel last night or this morning, apparently. 2 civilians were killed as a result of rocket fire from Hamas or Islamic Jihad out of Gaza. But you have 28 Palestinians killed, of whom, as we know, now 9 are children and 4 are women. So one side is carrying out quite significant attacks that are killing large numbers of civilians. The other side is carrying out attacks that are killing, has so far killed 2 civilians. As far as the U.S. government is concerned, one side, which is Israel, is doing this in exercise of a right of self-defense, which the U.S. supports, and the other side are just a bunch of terrorists. Somehow, some civilians invoke American protection, and some civilians don't. Some civilian deaths are terrorism, other civilian deaths are legitimate self-defense. And I think that's the position of the Biden administration, as it has been the position of several U.S. administrations going back for, unfortunately, quite a while.
The politics of this, help us understand that kind of overall politic and the particular points of pressure on the United States government to support the Nakba against the Palestinian people. So let's just kind of contextualize that.
I think that there certainly is a very influential lobby in support of anything and everything that Israel does. There's no question of that. And I think that we see this at the top of both political parties, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Leaderships are very committed to doing whatever Israel wants or defending whatever Israel does, and that there's a powerful lobby which is able to muster votes and which is able to muster campaign contributions to the leaderships of both parties. And this is just as true, I think, of the Democratic Party in terms of what influences their decision-making as it is of the Republicans. The difference, though, is that I think there are changes at the base of the Democratic Party that are going on unnoticed by the leaderships, or at least ignored by the leadership of the Democratic Party. You could see this at the convention in 2016 and 2020. You could see this in the kinds of appeals that Bernie Sanders made and that Senator Warren made in their campaigns for president, for the Democratic presidential nomination. And you can see this at the grassroots, support of increasing numbers of members of the Congressional Black Caucus, of increasing numbers of people like Chuy Garcia in Chicago, representing Latinx, mainly constituents. I think that at the base, there is beginning to be a change, at least in the base of the Democratic Party. And here you have a difference between the donor class and the career politicians at the top of the party and the rank and file in the Democratic Party. Many big donors to the Democratic Party are fervent supporters of Israel. Very large proportion. The polls are unequivocal. At the base of the Democratic Party, there's almost as much support for the Palestinians as there is for Israel, and on some questions more. That is not reflected in the leadership. We're talking about a generational difference. You know, this is a gerontocracy that runs the party. Pelosi is old. Biden is old. Kamala Harris is younger, obviously. We're talking about a generation for which the Holocaust is a vivid memory, a generation for which 1967, which has been pictured in the popular imagination as Israel on the brink of extermination, is a vivid memory. That's false, of course, but that's what people believed. And for whom Israel is a tiny, beleaguered democracy and an oasis of crazy Arabs. These are stereotypes that have been built up with great care over many decades, you know, making the desert bloom and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, the older people who are a large part of the donor class and who run the Democratic Party are invested in those ideas, even if they don't fully believe it. Whereas most younger people know that all of this is absolute nonsense. Israel is a bully. Israel is behaving in an awful manner. And you can see with the increasing valence of discussion of Zionism, what it really means, discussion of settler colonialism, discussion of apartheid, on college campuses, in academia, in many churches, in some synagogues, that at least as far as the younger generation is concerned, most of what their elders believe is complete nonsense. And so there's a generational gap, there's a wealth gap, there's all kinds of gaps in the Democratic Party, which, by the way, doesn't exist on the Republican side. The base and the leadership are in lockstep. They are very supportive of Israel. Evangelicals for one set of reasons, foreign policy hawks for another set of reasons, and people who are responding to donors for another set of reasons. So at least the Republicans are consistent.
So also the issue of geopolitical hegemony through Israel, which inherently means as a surrogate for our power in the region, is that still, I mean, that's still fundamentally the geopolitical strategy and reality which the U.S. cannot wean itself from. It cannot respect self-determination and the growth of other or existence of other sources of power. Is that fundamentally still the function of Israel, and thus compliance with the Israeli government's utter suppression of the very ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian peoples and their histories, at least an effort to from the land base itself? Is that how we are to understand what is primarily pushing the U.S. to have its unadulterated, indeed accelerated support financially and otherwise of the Israeli government?
I think that if you put this all in historical perspective, you can see a couple of phases. One was the Cold War era, where if you accepted Cold War logic, Israel was able to peddle itself as a American proxy against Soviet proxies. And that was all well and good. Israel served as a sort of a regional policeman against countries like Egypt and Syria and so forth that were aligned, seen as aligned with the Soviet Union. And that was well and good until the end of the Cold War, at the beginning of the 1990s. At the beginning of the 1990s, Israel lost its strategic role because the United States was increasingly influential in the Middle East, with the exception of Iran. Most countries were aligned with the United States, whether Turkey or Egypt or Saudi Arabia. And there was no longer a need for a policeman. Along came 9/11 and the terrorism, the war on terror, and suddenly Israel found a new role. It could lead in the region as an American ally and proxy against so-called global terrorists. And Israel had a great time conflating everything that had to do with violence, with whether it was Iran, whether it was Hezbollah, whether it was, you know, local movements that had nothing to do with the United States, or global terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. It conflated them all and joined in George W. Bush's war on terror, gleefully joined. And since then has, in some cases, I think, pushed American policy to even more militance vis-a-vis countries like Iran. And we could see this during the Obama administration, where Israel fought tooth and nail against the policy of the U.S. president to try and achieve a nuclear deal with Iran. Netanyahu was invited by the president's Republican opponents twice to speak before joint sessions of Congress. Once, he actually attacked the policy of the president of the United States from the well of the House chamber to a joint session of Congress. He's the only person except Winston Churchill to be invited more than once to speak to a joint session of Congress, and did so, as I've said, to attack the policy of the sitting president. And that's an example of Israel really throwing its weight around. It failed. The JCPOA, the agreement, the nuclear agreement with Iran, was rammed through by the president, who basically made a very powerful argument. We fought these two horrible wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you really want a third war with Iran? That's the only alternative to a nuclear deal. And that's how we managed to ram it through. We'll see if Israel is going to be successful in preventing the Biden administration from reestablishing that deal. They're doing their damnedest to prevent the United States returning to that nuclear agreement with Iran.
Dr. Rashid Ismail Khalid, Director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and author of The 100 Years War on Palestine, a must read to educate, agitate, and organize for a free, free Palestine. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're building bridges to the workers of the world. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.